Psalm 1. Now, this is my promise to you. We're going to do 2 weeks on Psalm 1, and it's because I really do think we need to get out of here because of the heat. So we're going to do 2 weeks on it. So I'm going to just do first two verses today, and then we're going to finish it up, do the latter part of it next week. So considering the two verses that we're going to cover today, look at verses 1 and 2. Blessed is the man or woman, the word there is ish, which is, thinking when you say a word in this passage, think of the word mankind instead of male, okay? The word is ish. The Hebrew word for female is isha. So since it's a derivative of ish, often the Bible would use the word man in reference to both men and women. Verse 1, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law, he, the man, meditates day and night. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. Now, there's a couple things we want to unpack here before we can get a big idea from what the passage is saying. And I'm hoping you notice it right away in verse 1. There is a devolving, a devolution of behavior in verse 1. Because when it starts out, the man, the woman, the person is... He is walking in the counsel of the wicked, and then it moves from being in motion to being still. He is now standing in the way of sinners, and then he gets to the point of becoming so comfortable that he takes a seat in the midst of the scoffers. Now we want to, but before we get into the walk, stand, sit quality of this, I think that stands out as obvious. We need to unpack what we mean by wicked, sinners, and scoffers. Who is he referring to when he refers to this group of people? Those who are wicked, those who are sinners, and those who are scoffers. Now, the word wicked is often in reference to any rebellion against that which is right. And sometimes a person can act out this rebellion independent of their view of God. So do not look at the word wicked right there at the beginning of verse 1 as an assault, a rebellion against God. It's a rejection of anything that is right, the right thing to do. Now, the reason that's relevant is it is possible for a person who does not know God. In fact, I would contend that it is absolute. It is mandatory. It's inevitable that a person who does not know God will still know that which is right. You may recall that from Romans chapter 2. If you didn't, then when we start back up in Romans in September, then we'll redo that sermon, okay? But it's a whole thing about him, everyone recognizing that which is right. Human beings have an innate understanding of right in contrast to that which is wrong. Okay. There is no exception to that. It's the reason Paul is able to say in both Romans 1 and 2 that all human beings are without excuse. We have an innate understanding. The way Paul puts it in Romans 2 is, it is written on our hearts. If you want to get a detailed work on this, then read C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man. It's one of the best defenses of natural law theory I've ever read. The Abolition of Man. It's brief, too. It's only about 60 pages. You can read it in an afternoon. And it's C.S. Lewis, so it's very well written. And it's a defense of how every human being knows that which is right in contrast to wrong, even if they do not have this book. It is the reason a missionary is able to go into a mission field in a remote part of the 1040 window and engage a tribe of people who do not even speak the languages into which this book has been translated, and they still have an understanding of thou shalt not murder. It's not because they've found it out by reading this book. It's because God has, in addition to writing it here, he has written it on the hearts of human beings. Are you tracking with that? The understanding of what property is, thou shalt not steal, is not an uncommon belief across cultural norms, even those that reject the Decalogue that we get from this book. And it's because God did not merely write it here, he also wrote it on the hearts of all human beings. Every human being has an innate understanding of that which is right versus wrong. What the author is addressing at the beginning of the psalm when he refers to the wicked is those who, independent of their view of God, reject that which is right. And keep note of what happens here. The man who is blessed is one who chooses to not walk alongside those who reject that which is right. Then he moves on from that group to a very specific group and identifies them as sinners. Now, what's the difference between, because often when I heard this passage preached, the wicked and the sinners are identified as the same group. And I would contend that they are not. It's very deliberate use of sin versus wicked in the beginning of the verse because he's showing how their behavior or rebellion is a direct rebellion against God. The wicked are rebelling against that which is right with no regard for God. The sinner is rebelling against right because it is associated with God. That's the distinction here. So he starts out with a group who rejects that which is right. Now, I want to say this. I do not believe that the wicked moves from one group to another. I don't believe he starts out with the wicked and then gets all he can from them and moves over to those who are sinners, those who oppose God. No, I believe that he's also describing the evolution or devolution of the group itself. So those who are rejecting that which is right, they move from rejecting it on its face. I reject this right thing because it doesn't appeal to me. They move from that, they devolve from that and say, I don't reject it because now I recognize that God's the one who put it in place. And the person who started out walking with them finds himself standing with them when they make a stand against God. And then it moves from being in the standing among those who are sinners, those who reject the right because of God, and to the place of taking a seat among the scoffers. So now he's not merely walking with them and hearing the counsel. He's not merely standing with them and applauding the council, but he has now taken a seat among them, and now he's voicing the scoffing. Do you see? It's this process of once you start in the bad place, then you start to devolve and go backward, and the rebellion against God becomes a more extreme display of your undesired, unwitting hatred of him. You went from merely being among them and listening to what they're saying to sitting down and saying it with them. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, I don't know what that's like. I wouldn't know what that's like because John the Baptist and I were anointed in our mother's wombs. So, well, I don't know what that's like. But here's what I'm taking note of, okay? There's two different schools of thought on how the church should engage the world. One of them is, and the problem is that these two, I would contend, are both wrong. The medium is often the right place to be in. So one of them is you should entirely disassociate with the world for fear that some of the world may get on you. I don't know. I disassociate from the world. We set up policies regarding people who can be in the church. And we say, fix yourself so that you can be here with us. Completely missing the fact that no human being is capable of fixing themselves. If fixing yourself was possible, then why would God allow the only begotten to die in an effort to repair us? You bring them to that place where the voice of God is spoken so they can experience the hands-on deliverance from God instead of saying, fix yourself so that you can have God. God knows you can't do that. He doesn't call you to him. He comes to get you. Okay, so we make the mistake of saying, fix yourself so you can be here. And therefore, we have disassociated ourselves from the world for fear that some of it may get on us. We don't want people to mess around and get contaminated, infected by the world. The problem with that is you can't be a witness to the world if you separate yourself from it. Okay. Right. The Bible does not say disassociate from the world. It says be in the world, but not of the world. His concern here is not that you disassociate, it's that you are unique. You're an outlier. You're distinct within the world. So go into the world and be a witness. Otherwise, the world cannot hear. What the Bible say in Romans 10? How can they hear unless there is a preacher? If all the preachers hoard themselves into one room, then the world is at a loss without us. And we're going to stand in this room and condemn them when the fact is the condemnation should be on us for not taking this message to them. That's the brokenness here. Then you have the other extreme where the whole idea is, well, because we have to be witnesses to the world, we should be so immersed in the world that we replicate everything they are. It's the reason Christian movies and songs are corny. When I watch a Christian movie, I see a desire to copy what the world has done on a significantly lower budget. And therefore incapable of doing it as well as the world did it. And you know what the world says when they see that? Corniness. Listen, look at them. How about this? We live in a context where the world looks at us and says, look at them trying to be like us. They want us to follow them while they try to be us. when the fact is we should do everything better than the world does and have them jealous of what God is doing in and through us. So one camp says disassociate, and the other camp says be so immersed in the world that they can't tell the difference between you and them. Become too. I have a friend. We have a friend in Dallas named Tori. He's not in Dallas. He's in Atlanta now. And Tori was the first one I ever heard say this. We would use language that I'm not talking about profanity, but just like world language. And Tori would say, "B, you're being too relevant right now. That's too relevant. You're being too relevant right now." And I really appreciate the language he's using there. It's this problem of looking so much like the world that the world can't tell the difference between you and them. It's the first time I became a believer, and I tried to read through the Bible. I may have told you this before. The first book I chose was the book of Job, because my mom told me to read the book of Job. I don't know why she did that to me. So I'm reading it in my King James version of the Bible, okay? And I got through the first two chapters, and I understood the first two chapters because I'd heard someone explain the first two chapters. So I pretty much got that. But once you get to chapter 3 and the conversation started happening, and because these friends showed up and they started talking sideways about Job, I got about 7-8 chapters in and realized I have not understood a word I've read for the past 2 hours. I put all these words behind me, but I have no idea what they mean. So then my mother tells me that I should read a more contemporary translation, and we were trying to figure out what that was. And at the time, when I was a brand new believer, there was a very popular translation of the Bible called the Good News Bible. It was this gold hardcover Bible that said Good News, and it was not a translation, it was a paraphrase. And I mean hard paraphrase. Don't use it, okay? And at the same time, there were other paraphrases that were coming out that were attempting to speak the language of contemporary young readers, and one of them was a hip-hop Bible. True story, okay? Do you remember the passage in the Bible where Jesus... It's about Matthew 7, where they're on the Sea of Galilee and the storm is just tumultuous around them and the disciples are afraid. And Jesus decides to flex on them and just starts jump out on this tumultuous water and starts walking around. And all the other disciples are fascinated. But Peter, being Peter, looks at Jesus and says, "Hey, yo, Jesus, let me get some of that walk on water, okay?" Now, I don't remember that in the Bible, but that's what it says in the hip hop Bible. True story. And I was like, I don't know if Peter said, "Hey yo, Jesus," though. What's the Hebrew, what's the Greek translation like? What's the "Hey yo, Jesus" of this? I don't know. Where do we get that from? And I remember thinking, that's too relevant. I need for you to tell me precisely what Peter said. Don't give me this filtered translation of it before I get to my interpretation of the text. I want to be very careful how we do this. How do we replicate this one camp? How do we replicate the world so much that they look at us and say, they're one of us, and therefore they're not afraid of us? Those are the two camps. And I'm saying that the split should be in the middle, where you're in the world and you are gospel fluent. In other words, you know how to speak the language that the world speaks, but you don't do it in an artificial, contrived manner that keeps them incapable of distinguishing between you and them. You should not stand over them as superior because you're saved by grace, but you should be able to speak the language. But here's the thing. While the language is the same, the message should not be the same. So you should be able to convey the gospel to them in terms that are on par with their cultural understanding. It's the reason a believer should have a Bible in one hand and Time magazine in the other. It's the reason you should have a newspaper in one hand and a Greek New Testament in the other. Because you should not just be expositing the passage, you should be expositing the world so that you can convey the passage to the world. That's not what the man is doing in Psalm 1. He is walking among them, and he is not distinct from them. And therefore, he adopts their language. And along with language comes philosophy. So after he adopts the language and the philosophy, he sits down and he spews the mistaken ideas that are coming out of this camp. Now, what's the difference between wicked, sinners, and scoffers? The wicked choose that which is wrong. The sinners choose that which is antithetical, opposing God. The scoffers take the position of mocking the God whom they are opposing. It's a vocal rejection of God. It's the difference between being an atheist and being an anti-theist. An atheist does not believe that God exists. An anti-theist thinks that it's wrong for you to believe that God exists. And many atheists are actually anti-theists. They're scoffers. They mock us for believing that the universe had a cause. Everything must have a cause, but they mock for believing that the universe has a cause that must be distinct from the universe that was caused. That, to me, is mockable. It's kind of odd that the position, those sitting in the position that is mockable, mock those who hold the right view. This man, if the non-blessed man in verse 1, is walking, standing, and sitting with this devolving camp and taking that philosophy. But notice what the author of the passage says. The first thing he says is, those who do not do that are blessed. Those who do not do that are blessed. Now, there's two things I want to take from verses 1 and 2, and I'm actually going to stop talking when I'm done with those two. Watch this. No, listen, because last week y'all called me on it, and I don't like being challenged. I'm petty. So I got called on that. I owe you 10 minutes. I'm going to give you 12, okay? I'm going to give you 12 minutes of your life back today. Watch. The two things I want you to take from verses 1 and 2 are, the author's appealing to your joy. The way you read the word blessed in this passage should be informed by how it's used in the rest of the Psalms. This word is being the word that's translated blessed in verse 1 is used, depending on who you ask, either 26 or 28 times throughout the book of Psalms. And every single time it's used, it should be understood as rejoicing, joyful, delighting, every single time. So he's saying, joyful is the man who does not walk, stand, and sit among this group. We think that that is the place that draws us to joy, going to the place of mockers, sinners, and scoffers. But the author is saying those who do not choose to be identified with that camp experience delight. In fact, look at what he says in verse 2. Because verse 2 is essentially his contrasting summary of what he just said in verse 1. He says in verse 2, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. Notice what he does there. He said he delights in the Lord, the law of the Lord. He's contrasting the two. He's giving you the negative display and the positive display. So he's saying the blessed man does not do this. In verse 2, he says that he does do this. The words that you should recognize as the parallel in verses 1 and 2 are blessed and delight. He says he does not delight in walking among the wicked or standing in the midst of the sinners or taking a seat among the scoffers. Instead, he delights in that which brings God joy, which is the law of God. So the word you should identify with the word blessed in verse 1 is rejoicing. In other words, God is to be your exceeding joy. And if God is your exceeding joy, then taking joy in him will directly inform the manner in which you walk, stand, and sit. It will directly inform the group among whom you decide to walk, stand, and sit. There's another psalm that we may actually cover before the end of the month. It's Psalm 37. It says, rejoice in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. And I had my momentary prosperity gospel soapbox last week. And I think I'm allowed to do that maybe once or twice a year. So I'm about to mess up both of them in a span of 2 weeks. Because I've heard the prosperity gospel camp use that psalm horribly. Because the idea is, if you rejoice in God, then he will give you whatever you ask for. That's how they're reading that passage. It says, rejoice in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. And they're thinking that, and because our minds automatically go to that which is material, we think that if I rejoice in God, and I desire a mansion, then God will give me a mansion. But that's not what the passage means. It says, if you rejoice in God, then God will place in your heart the desires that your heart should have. That's what the passage actually means. It's not referring to material. It's referring to you. It's not referring to stuff you get. The change that comes from rejoicing in God occurs in you. If you rejoice in God, then you want what God wants. And it could be that God's plan for you is 1,600 square feet instead of 5,000. But if you want God, then you want God what God wants. Then you will be rejoicing in the 1,600 square feet. Because your heart is turned toward him instead of the stuff that you can get from him. That's relevant to Psalm 1 because he says that the man delights in the law of the Lord. Now, we don't have time today because it's hot. But in verses 3 through 6, he explains the implications of delighting in the law of the Lord. He tells you what this man looks like, not because of a willful decision of his own, not because he white-knuckled his way through this thing, but because he merely surrendered his heart to an affection for God. And as a result of him surrendering his heart to God in that manner, his life displayed where his affections lie. Which brings me to my next point. People can tell where your delights are by looking at you. I'm sorry. I thought we all thought we were hiding in plain sight. But people can tell where your delight is by looking at you. Now, here's what you should delight in right now. This is my second and last point. But it's the one I want you to leave with and hold deeply. People get a glimpse of where your joy is by looking at you. People can tell. And here's what you need to really appreciate. They are looking. When I was in college, I worked for the post office, the United States Post Office. It's the reason I don't send stuff through the mail to this day. I hope none of you work for the post office. If you do, Nez gets the emails. But it's the reason I don't send stuff through the post office to this day. Not if I want to get it there, not if I value it. I'm sorry. I worked in the post office. I saw the shenanigans happening in the post office. And about six people who worked at that post office went to the same church. And I knew their pastor personally. Okay? Personally. And four of those six people were married. In fact, I knew the spouse of one of the four. And all four of those six people were cheating on their wives with people who lived in houses on their routes. And then would come back to the station and boast about what they got done during their lunch hour while they were out on the route. This is a true story. I was 19 years old, had been a believer for about 3 months, okay? I knew their pastor before becoming a Christian. And it's a very large church in Dallas. Very large church in Dallas. They would come back from their day and boast of their behavior, their engagements, while they were out. And I actually said to one of them, man, I know your wife. And she's beautiful. And he said to me, when you get a little bit older, young buck, you'll understand. I said, well, wait a minute. Now, you're like three times my age. I figure at this age, this is where I should be living the way you living. This is a new Christian me. And this is a man who had been married for as long as I had been alive at that point. And that was his, not only was he doing it, but he was bragging about it. Now, keep that in your mind. 2 weeks went by. And you know what every one of them did, without exception, independent of one another, came to me and invited me to church. I said, man, wait a minute. Why would I go to a church that has somehow managed to produce this group of people who value marriage this lowly? Are you kidding me? They didn't realize this, but while they were having this boastful moment, this boastful huddle regarding their adultery, I was watching. And I could tell that while they spoke of God, their delight is in something else. And I can always tell where their delight is, not based on what they're saying, but based on the things that they were doing. People can tell that which is your joy. They can tell that which is central to your identity based on looking at you. We don't like that, though, because we'll say things like, well, you know, I mean, I may be doing this, but God knows my heart. Here's the problem with God knowing your heart. He knows the thing you're doing is more valuable to you than him. I'm guessing based on your behavior. God has never guessed in his life. There are things that God cannot do. You do know that, right? God cannot cease to exist. God cannot create another God. God cannot guess. He's incapable of guessing. When you know everything, nothing is a guess. So he's not guessing where your affections are. He knows. So don't come to me with that God knows my heart thing, because you may not want God to know your heart. If you could hide your heart from God, that may be the best plan for you if you're going to continue to prioritize things over him. We think that these things that we do in public are not necessarily a revelation of who we are in private. And I'm saying, yeah, they are. People can get a glimpse of who you are, that which is your joy, what your delights are, by looking at you. And here's what you need to appreciate. They are looking. Pastor Derek is the pastor of Missional Communities at the Embassy Church. Okay, when I got ready to write a proposal for this church, one of the things I was told to do by my mentors was put together a team, because we prioritize team. I was discipled among a camp in Little Rock, Arkansas that values team. So they were saying to me, put your team together before you launch the church. And there were, how many do we have at St. John? Was it about a dozen of us maybe? About a dozen of us. The pulpit was always full. We had a pulpit, and it was always full. In fact, I did not notice, but I had a quiet favor because my aunt came to church, because there was the big chair in the middle where Pastor sat, and there were two smaller chairs that were on each side of him, and there were all the other chairs in the pulpit were smaller than that. And whenever we got in the pulpit, I sat in one of the big chairs next to Pastor. I never noticed it. Because my aunt's like, you be sitting right next to the pastor when you up there. I said, I sit in a big chair because I need a bigger chair. It's not a place of nobility. I don't want to sit in that small chair. And it was all, and we did all these things together, okay? But when it was time for us to plant the church, I only called on two of them. I hold all these men in high regard. All of them, okay? But I only called on two of them. I called Pastor Derek, and I called Pastor Greg Ely, who preached our fifth church anniversary. He preached a sermon entitled Celebrate But Don't Settle. I just listened to it the other day. He preached the paint off the walls, and I got mad at him all over again, because when I asked him to move to Denver, he said, I can't. And it's because he had just taken a senior pastor position in Kansas City. But at our church in Dallas, he managed the finances. And while he was managing the finances, I was watching him. And there was one time I sat down with him over a meal, and he told me the names, not the name of the company, but the name of the contact person of every vendor the church had. Every vendor. The church's insurance vendor was named Leslie. I don't know why I remember that. Her name was Leslie. I do recall asking him, why do you know her name? He said, if you are responsible for money, then you need to know every single person you are paying, especially when the money you're using to pay them is not yours. When he said that, I was watching him. He was putting himself on display for me. He also told me that the insurance is due on the 20th, but they give you a 5-day grace period. So he didn't pay him until the 25th. I said, wait a minute, that's late. He said, late don't count until it's a penalty, bro. And sometimes the giving is lower than it should be. So until a penalty's coming, I don't pay it. And I said, so you have managed to figure out not just the person, but the rhythm and the grace periods and all that stuff like that. And he said, yes. I said, well, he said to me, I'm saying, I'm paying attention. I'm watching him. He doesn't realize it, but I'm looking at him. And I'm getting a glimpse of who he is based on what he does. And y'all have seen him preach. The first time I saw him preach, I said, okay, enough said. Move to Denver. He said, no, because God gave him another call. But the, whatever that was. But the, I'm still kind of iffy about that. But but I remember taking note of him and saying, I hold this man in high regard, not because of stuff that he has said about himself, but because of the stuff I watch him doing. You look at him and you see what it is. I called Pastor Derek. I said, Pastor Derek, how do we nurture community? And he had all these plans. And I said, I don't like any of this. We used to argue about this so hard. And then I started to pay attention to the life that he was living. and tried to parallel it with what he was telling me. And the thing I noticed was he wasn't telling me what he thought was a good idea on paper. He was telling me that which he valued so much that he was carrying it out in his life. So if you know them well, the Kelseys will have you all up in their house. Yeah, I'm talking about like had to give more space so they could have you all up in their house, okay? And Easter Seders and all kinds of stuff like that. That's the life that they actually live. He doesn't prioritize missional communities because that's his job. He's a missional community person, and therefore, we asked him to do that job here. How do we think that was a good idea? Because I watched him. And I saw that that which he was saying was consistent with that which he genuinely believes. I know where his values are because I watched him. In addition to us running that turkey trot, there's a gym on Weldon Street, and the owner of that gym is named Courtney Samuel, and we're gonna get a whole bunch of people from that gym to join us to run that turkey trot with us. Courtney is a personal trainer. He's our personal trainer. It's the official gym of the Embassy Church. Okay, okay. So, and Courtney doesn't like to run, which I find odd, because he's just yelp jacked. Do you hear me? He's just like I have to, whenever I'm around Courtney, I say, Courtney, hey man, I'm a pastor, yo, put your shirt on, because this is making me uncomfortable, okay? Because he's just all the time, okay? Just wakes up like that too. Like, you know, in the movies when you watch the Avengers, you do know that Thor gets down and does push-ups right before they shoot the scene so he can kind of tighten himself up. Courtney has never done that ever. Never, because he's just ripped, just built like a sculpture. It's just marble. He knows it too. He knows it. And so we're saying to him, he said to me, well, if you guys do this on this day, if you meet a certain goal, which, come on, it's going to happen. He said, if you meet a certain goal, I'll run that race with you, and we'll get people from the gym here to join us and run that race. Listen to me very carefully, okay? Don't call me out, because I'm petty. So if you challenge me to meet a goal, you run this race. And there's another boxing trainer there who says, but Courtney don't like to run. I said, well, he gonna like it that day because he's running this race. And he says, but Brandon, you get down, I'm only gonna run it if you get down to this certain goal. I said, listen to me very carefully. 2 days before the Turkish trot, I'm gonna be like Mike Tyson in a hotel room, sauna, just sweating it off, because you gonna run this race, bro. You running this race. And you gonna lose. So I'll cross the finish line and die. And then tell you, I told you, okay? See, that's how this whole thing works out. And he has this thing where he forces me, that's why he has to run the race, he forces me to do things that I hate. One of them is, he will make me get down on a sponge roller and do push-ups on the sponge roller. And as I'm getting ready to push up, I have this fear that because it's cylindrical, it's going to roll from under me while I'm pushing up, and I'm going to face plant into the floor, and everyone in the room is going to laugh at me. He knows I hate that. He knows I hate that. And yet, for some reason, he finds a way to work that into our routine every single time. He knows I hate that sled. The sled's name is Cyrus. I hate that sled. And he makes me do push-ups every single time. And he makes them harder. So it involves yoga blocks. Put your hand up on the yoga block and then push up and then lift this arm up for no good reason. And then put it back down and then ease down. And he says, and it don't count until your chest touches the floor. Does he make you do this? It doesn't count until your chest touches the floor. I will not say a number out loud until your chest touches the floor, and then you come back up. And he makes me do this on a roller knowing it's going to kill me. He knows I'm going to die, and he puts me on this roller anyway. But you got to understand this. I'm petty. So what I did is I went and I bought one of the rollers so I'd be at home, get my practice on. Listen to me. I am not a guy who likes losing. Okay, so I'm at home, and I'm like, Sheree, count me when I go down. And it doesn't count until the roller touches your chest. And so every single time I hit this chest, I'm like, yeah, Courtney's going to run that race. He's running this race with us. I'm in the midst of, and he knows he can make me do it. You know why? Because when we first went to the gym, I told him, Doc, I have opinions on this stuff, but I'm keep all of them to myself, and whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. Whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. You know why I told him that? I looked at him. And when I looked at him, I saw like 6% body fat. His teeth are strong. One of my issues with him is that he will show me the exercise by doing it himself and then turn to me and say, now you do that. And he'll knock it out real fast. And I struggle with the ease with which he did it and then hands it over to me and says, now you do it. Or he'll have me do these farmer walks and he'll grab like 200 pound belts and walk from there and come back. And then he comes back, he'll say, now you pick up those 20s. I said, man, wait a minute. Give me the hundreds. He says, no, we want to ease you into it. I said, no, give me the hundreds. I will die. But when he makes me do the 20s instead of the hundreds, I say, I did tell you I'm going to do exactly what you tell me to do. You know why? Because I looked at him. And I can look at Courtney and tell that which he values. The life he lives is reflected by what I see. When people look at you, they know where you walk. They know among whom you stand. They can pick your seat out in the room because the life you are living displays what your delight is. When was the last time you decided that God is enough? That he is not the provider of your exceeding joy, but he is your exceeding joy. And all of his provisions are just the cherry on top. If you are alone in a box on the street and God is with you, you can have what the Bible refers to as a joy that is unspeakable, this inexplicable joy. Why? Because God is legitimately enough. Do the laws of God's commandments directly inform your joy? Now, here's why this is significant for me. Because the day will come when that joy gets tested. Everyone in here, you're either coming out of that test, you are presently enduring that test, or praying for you, you're headed for one. And people can know where your delight is based on how you respond to that test. I cannot tell you how many people have chosen to walk away from God because of something that God did not give them. And when I hear that, I say the thing that he did not give you was your actual God. And you had the temerity to chastise him for not okaying you worshiping something other than him. What is your joy? Am I saying that stuff is bad? No. Am I saying you should just become a hermit and live in a hut out in the middle of the desert? No, unless God tells you to do that. But I'm not saying that that's what you have to do to be close to him. I'm not telling you to live this shunning, this monkish lifestyle, and that it's wrong for you to have stuff. But my question is, while you stand in the midst of this stuff, can people look at you and see that you value this stuff more than you value the God who provided the stuff? Where is your joy? Because it gets tested. We mentioned a few weeks ago that we want you to be praying for Pastor Matt Wojcicki and his family because roofers were repairing the roof on their house, and they did this torch sheeting where much of its tars involved, and they did not properly manage it and ended up burning their house down. Ended up burning Matt's house down. And Matt has five kids. Yeah. And the youngest about 18 months old. And they lost everything. I'm not just talking about financial assets. I'm talking about stuff that you can't replace. Photos from their children's births and things of that sort. They lost everything. his office is above ours, on the second floor of the same building as ours. And he was in the office with his one of his daughters, and he stopped by, and I was asking how he's doing. And the thing I couldn't help but take note of was how entirely unbent, how unbroken he was after this horrible incident hit his family. I mean, I had to say something. I said, bruh, let me tell you something right now. I have never seen anyone lose an entire house and handle it this well. I have never seen it. The house he lived in is the only home three of his children have ever known. And it is gone. It is a pile of rubble two blocks from here. It's right across the street from the school. And it is a pile of destroyed. And he was telling me about how much trouble he's having because the insurance company is not going to cover the entirety of the damage. So now he's going to have to go after the construction company to make up the balance and all the complications. And he's saying he may even have to come to them with some punitive stuff because insurance things have become a part-time job for him. He's on the phone for hours every day trying to resolve who is responsible for taking care of what. In fact, one of the observations that they made was the construction company left propane tanks on his roof that by the grace of God did not explode in the fire. That kind of stuff. And his mind went to, listen to this, his mind went to the fact that God protected them from exploding propane tanks instead of fixing on the fact that his house burned down. And my comment to him was, I see you. And by looking at you, I can see where your joy actually is. Because the entire time, instead of being on a tirade against the construction company, his voice spoke of the God who protected him, his wife, and his children from the inevitable, because the fire occurred overnight. The fire smoldered for the entirety of the day, and he did not discover it until they were all asleep in their beds, and God protected a family of seven. His voice is on what God did and not what the construction company did, because he knows where his delight is. And by watching him, I too can see it. Where is your joy? When God takes something from you or decides to not give you something, are you angry at God? Because if you are, you have to ask yourself, do I value the thing I do not have over the God who did not provide it? When God gets fired because of what he did not give you, then you are showing yourself where the God actually is. And I'm asking us to have minds that are blessed, living the life, walking the walk, taking the stand, and sitting in the seat of the blessed man of verse 1. Let's pray.